Hello, this is Lingua Franca with me, Maria Zylstra, here on ABC Radio National, as well as on the World Wide Web. And you know how last week the Paris correspondent for the Times of London, Charles Bremner, told us about French efforts to resist encroachments of English upon their language? Well, this week, a bit of a delve into the effects of French on English, and in particular on the upper and more formalised aspects of English society, like the law, from times long ago, specifically due to the Norman invasion of England. Here's Julian Burnside, who, as an amateur philologist and Queen's Counsel, knows.
The effect on the English language of the Norman invasion is well known and easily observed even now. From 1066 until Normandy was lost by King John in 1204, the ruling class in England was comprised largely of nobles whose native land was France. After 1204, a sense of allegiance to France became progressively less relevant. By that time, however, a large number of Anglo-Saxon words had been displaced by Norman French equivalents. Because the Norman rulers were truly a conquering force, they did not assimilate in quite the same way as the Scandinavians had 200 years earlier. Thus, the influence of French on English is greatest where the influence of the ruling invaders was greatest. So, the language of government, law, military leadership, and the baronial table is dominated by French words. The language of the farm, the fields, and the trades shows a healthy survival of Anglo-Saxon words. In Ivanhoe, Sir Walter Scott identified the language divide between farm and table. The English serfs tended the Anglo-Saxon boar, calf, cow, bull, deer, ox, sheep, pig, and swine. At the table, the Norman overlords ate the French brawn, veal, beef, venison, mutton, pork, and bacon. It's tempting to add ham to this list. The connection with the French jambon, for leg, and Italian gamba is obvious and plausible. However, ham existed as hom before the Norman conquest, meaning the part of the leg at the back of the knee. In the language of the law, it's difficult to find words which do not derive from the Norman influence. Apart from obviously French words, tort, oyer and termine, assize, malfeasance, puny, many others are French but are so completely naturalised as to pass unnoticed. Arrest, accused, acquit, convict, punish, pardon, plea, sue, damage, and so on. Indict is a Norman French word. It derives in turn from the Latin dictare, to say or declare. So, originally, it was a statement or declaration by which a person was made aware of charges against them. Its use was not confined to the law. As late as the 18th century, Handel wrote the coronation anthems, one of which is called My Heart is Inditing, the sense of which is that heartfelt sentiments for the new King George are put into words. Parliament is another obvious Norman French word. It comes from parlement, speaking. The Anglo-Saxon word it replaced was wittenagemot, discussion of the wise men. Perhaps circumstances would eventually have forced the abandonment of that word in any event. Although wittenagemot has not been used since the 11th century, it has left a small legacy to modern English. The constituent roots are wittan, wise men, and mot, discussion. Mot was a variant of moot, a discussion or debate. It survives in our moot courts and in the idiom moot point. It's not uncommon to hear it said that the point is moot, with the intended meaning that the point does not arise for debate, especially because it is hypothetical. A moot point is one which is debatable or doubtful. It's not accurate to use it as meaning hypothetical, although a hypothetical question clearly can be debatable. As a verb, to moot an idea is to raise it for discussion. Another interesting byproduct of the French influence on the English courts is culprit. At least from the time of the yearbooks, when a prisoner had pleaded not guilty, the clerk of the crown would assert the guilt of the prisoner, culpable, and announce the readiness of the crown to prove its charge, prêt d'avere nostre bill. This form is found repeatedly in the yearbooks. The word prêt, P-R-E-S-T, was also written as P-R-I-S-T, P-R-I-T and P-R-E-T. It corresponds to the modern French prêt, ready. The written record of a trial often used abbreviations for formulaic portions of the proceeding. Thus, it is thought, the formula culpable prêt d'avere nostre bill was abbreviated to cul prêt, or culprit. It was later mistaken for a mode of addressing the prisoner. Culprit is first recorded as a word in 1678 in the record of the trial of the Earl of Pembroke. The Oxford Dictionary gives the following quotation. Clerk of Crown, are you guilty or not guilty? The Earl, not guilty. Clerk of Crown, culprit, how will you be tried? Earl, by my peers. Clerk of Crown, God send you a good deliverance. And what about that curious word premises, which lawyers and logicians use so often? Normal people speak of the premises, meaning the house or other building that concerns them. Logicians speak of the premises, meaning the starting propositions of a syllogism. Lawyers, wanting to summarise all that went before without having to repeat it, say, in the premises. They are all the same word, with the same original meaning, and, as ever, lawyers use the word in its ancient and proper sense. Premises are previous statements or propositions from which a stated conclusion follows. A formal conveyance of real estate begins with a recitation of the parties, a description of the property, and the vendor's title. Lawyers refer to those details later in the deed as the premises, just as logicians would. Laymen naturally take that as a reference to the most important part of the premises, namely the property conveyed. At least one legal expression in common use, bylaw, escaped the Norman influence and survives as a reminder of the earlier Scandinavian influence on English. The Danish by means town or settlement. By is found as a suffix in many place names, such as Derby, Normanby, Whitby, Rugby, Kirkby, and so on. It was readily assimilated into Anglo-Saxon because of its similarity to burg and Scottish bur and the English borough. Bylaws were, and generally still are, the local laws of a town or region.
Julian Burnside, reading from the revised and expanded edition of Word Watching, Field Notes from an Amateur Philologist, published late last year, which also includes this lovely piece, an explication of what has been a major linguistical battle here in Australia.
The pronunciation of the eighth letter of the English alphabet is one of Australia's great social shibboleths. Not just the way it is sounded as the first letter of a word, but more particularly the way the name of the letter itself is said. Some people say H, others call it H. Although the spirit of our times is generous, forgiving and tolerant, the choice between H and H can cause a good deal of anxiety and even hostility. Generally speaking, H is used by those educated in that part of the Roman Catholic school system that traces its origins to Ireland. H is preferred by the rest. Some apostates deny their origins by abandoning H, but there's not much traffic in the other direction. When I was a child, I was forbidden to say H, and friends who said H were appalled that I ate meat on Fridays. It's not at all surprising that the issue is so confused, since the pronunciation of H, when used as the initial letter of a word, has changed significantly over the past couple of millennia. Although nothing much is certain in matters of language, the prevailing view, perhaps illogically, supports the pronunciation H. The Oxford English Dictionary gives it thus and does not recognise H as an alternative. I say this is illogical because it might be expected that the name of a letter of the alphabet would give some clue to the sound normally associated with it. In this matter, H, W and Y stand isolated from the rest of the alphabet, although the names of C, E and G represent only the lesser part of the work done by those letters. The issue is manifested in at least three ways. How is the name of the letter to be said? Is the H sounded or not before a vowel? And does a word beginning with H accept A or an as the indefinite article? The sound represented by H was known in the Semitic, Greek and Latin alphabets. In the Semitic, it was a laryngeal or guttural aspirate, and remained so in the Greek and Latin. It passed from the Latin into the Germanic languages as a simple aspirate, that is to say, the sounded breath. It's been variously called ha, aha, acha, and akka. In these earlier forms, the name is clearly referable to the sound represented. In late Latin, and in early Italian and French, the aspirate gradually ceased to be sounded. In Italian, the H was progressively dropped in the written form of words so that it's now absent from words which, in the French, retain it without sounding it. Eretico, eretique. Storia, histoire. horribile, horrible, osteria, hotel. In Anglo-Saxon speech, H was always sounded, but from the Norman Conquest, the English pronunciation of words with an initial H gradually adopted the French manner. The English language has always been something of a trollop, pursuing advantage where it can, so for hundreds of years, H was seen but not heard in proper speech, at least in words which derive from the Romance languages. If the initial H of a noun or adjective is not sounded, the word naturally takes the indefinite article, an. At least from the 11th century then, it was natural to refer to an estuary, an hotel, an hour, an honourable woman, an humble person. The ambivalence of usage survives in words like hostler and ostler. However, from the 18th century on, English usage began once more to aspirate the initial H. This coincides with the arrival of the Hanoverian monarchs, whose native language had always sounded the H. Thus, words that had come into English via French began to be said with aspirated H's, although the change was gradual and patchy. Published in 1828, Walker's Pronouncing Dictionary says that H is always sounded, except in various words, and the list includes air, honest, honour, herb, herbage, hospital, ostler, hour, humble, humour, and humoursome. Since then, of course, a number of those have changed. Although in America, herb is still said with a silent H. One of the oddest anomalies of this process is habitué, which is an unassimilated French word, but which is generally spoken with a sounded H. By contrast, an habitual liar is commonly said with a silent H, although it would be odd not to sound the H in habit. Homage, homage, is likewise anomalous. As the shift back to aspirating the H was slow and illogical, it's not surprising that it provoked uncertainty in the choice of the indefinite article. The choice is made the more difficult by a dread of dropping an H, which in many circles is a shocking thing if done inappropriately. The unhappy result is such usages as an hotel, an historic occasion, an hypothesis, an heroic effort, an hysterical outburst, etc. If the H is sounded, the result is silly and indefensible. The rule is simple enough. A word which begins with a vowel sound takes an. A word which begins with a consonant sound takes a. So, an honest person, an hour, an heir, an unusual event, etc. A hypothetical case, a historic occasion, but occasionally an historic occasion, a useful suggestion, etc. Before initials, the choice of article depends on the way the name of the letter is sounded. A UN resolution, an S-bend, an HB pencil, an X-ray, an MP. But if the collection of letters is a recognised acronym, the choice of article depends on how the acronym is said. A UNICEF official, a NATO resolution, a SALT meeting, a Hojo restaurant. The anguish associated with sounding the initial H or not remains common amongst many English speakers. One case where the H has crept in from error and remained is humble pie. Most of us have eaten it metaphorically, few have done so literally. It's a pie made from the entrails of a deer, the part left over when those of higher station have taken what they want. The entrails of a deer are the umbles. The dish is umble pie. The H is an intruder which preserves the meaning of the phrase but disguises its origins.
The barrister Julian Burnside QC on How We Speak. Reading from Word Watching, Field Notes from an Amateur Philologist, published by Scribe. For Lingua Franca at abc.net.au/rn/linguafranca, I'm Maria Zylstra. Ciao for now.